Happy that you guys are here today. Everybody here knows who I am. I am the proud aunt of Tashambe CQ, the poet and author of Freedom as It Happens. I am so pleased and proud to be here today to introduce him to you guys. Nothing he does, everything he does, has a purpose. Tashambe is an obedient son, a loyal brother, a dedicated United States Navy service member, where he has served for 20 years. He is a devoted husband and father to the beautiful and remarkable Deidre Harris. They have been married for 14 years, and together they are the proud parents of 2-year-old Princess Nina. Tashambe says, in his eyes, Nina is the vision of the future. Continuing on his path of progress, overcoming struggles, defining and redefining realities of freedom, Tashambe started his creative writing over 10 years ago, and today he is an award-winning author for his verbal jazz collection, The Messenger, and his published poems, Victims of Violence and Tragedy, for Trayvon Martin. In addition to that, Tashambe is the founder of the Freedom Verse Cafe. That is an online broadcast that promotes positive artistic expressions. There, Tashambe was able to meet prolific and historic poets. Now, besides all of that, he loves all genres of music, drinking coffee, and baking bread. He is a fascinating and the coolest person you'd ever want to meet. And today we are in for a treat. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming poet Tashambe CQ, the author of Freedom as It Happens.
Thank you, my brother. I really appreciate it. I'm happy to be here today, and one of the first things I want to do before I begin my first reading is I'd like to thank the Creator, our Heavenly Father, for His traveling mercies and the opportunity to appear before you today, because anybody who's been on the road today know there was a potential of a storm, so I'm most grateful, and I'm glad that you're here tonight, so I appreciate that too. So I'm going to get started, give you a little warm-up with a couple of poems, and then we'll open up for some discussion, if there be any, and then we'll go on from there. So the first poem I'm going to read for you tonight out of the book, Freedom as It Happens, which is a selection of poems that were written over the last past 10 years. It's a poem called, doesn't have a title, it's called Untitled Number 34, with a subtitle of... I just didn't think deep enough for a title. All right, so the first mistake we make happens when we ask our children to pretend. Imagine themselves being something other than who they are. What do you want to be when you grow up? As if I'm insufficient of being who I am. Certainly, if I said I wanted to be a poet, more than anything, the retort would have been, no, seriously. Give it some thought and give a real answer later. And like that, we became something less than ourselves, more of what is pleasing and acceptable to the popular. Now we are the pretenders. I learned to pretend before I learned to be real. It was expected. I pretended to be emotionless, inexpressively male, pretended to love before I knew what it was, pretended it never hurt when it did, cool when I knew it shouldn't have, acted like an actor, played my parts until they seemed like truths. I pretended until pretending made me face the real truth, and truthfully, even then, I couldn't tell the difference. We pretended because it is expected when everyone else is pretending too. I pretended to love until it, love, got real with me. The next poem I'm going to read to you is Oppressed and Hunted for Your Skin, or How I Learned the Difference Between White and Black. As a matter of fact, you were born in the ghettos of charity, in America's blackest of cities, full of jazz and people drowning in waters held back long before the levees broke, by a history forever folding on itself. For this is where his pale ankle bone pressed itself against our throats. You were born here, far across the Atlantic. You have genetically been transplanted, ushered over fabled Atlanteans, delivered from your mother's womb, like your ancestors who were vomited upon the shores out of the bellies of Spanish boats with Christian sails. You are identified Negro by birth. This, your branding, your ensign made of kintenge, by which they will profile, hunt, and oppress you, because you are masculine. You are the spade they fear, the jigaboo whose skin they disdain. They seek to crucify, nail each hand to either end of the hyphen, name stolen, ethnicity bridged between two mothers. We have walked the tightrope, told its length carefully as ordered, spread our wingspans with each fist, desperately clenching the shores as if to bridge the contrast of two souls. One stolen and the other a lost wanderer. We are searching for the missing pieces that fit in the empty space, the equatorial line that crosses our hearts, Africa hyphen America. Walk the line or do the time. The future, looking into the past, or we will be their scriptures. There in the distance of time, will they call this a renaissance? They who will define their present by our past? Will they haunt themselves with our ghostly words weaved in the intricate fabrics of confusion? We whiff dwellers like rain caught between heaven and earth, looking for renewal, as hearts after lost and unrequited love. How do we fix time that has been broken? Clocks unable to spring through its rivers. Frustrated in war, with war, for war. Dying to make peace with something, anything. Searching for pieces of ourselves in boxes of discarded nothings. Will they call us a renaissance? We who see the world in waves, not round or flat, or a place, but a concept filled with distortion, seeking revolutions, trying to evolve into human 2.0, trying to revive some thing, like the dead ones. What will they call us? We, the present. You know, it is always a pleasure when one can share openly the thing that offers freedom. And in this case, it is being a poet sharing poetry with you. And primarily that's because I believe poems are personal. And anytime you share something personal, a bond begins to form. I also know that poems are perceptional because they naturally conjure questions and answers. And that's whether you're the reader or the listener or even the writer. So let me open it this time. If If you have any questions about anything you heard thus far, or if anything has settled with you from what you heard in the pieces. But now I'll talk a little bit about how I got to writing this book before I read some more poems. Anything?
Yeah, I got
yes, yes.
When was it you really accepted your blackness?
You know,
when you accepted your blackness, what did you define as that? That blackness.
You know, it's funny you should ask that question because I've often asked my question, often ask myself, do I wake up every morning and say, man, I'm black? And then go about my day and define my day by that? I think the first time I knew that I was black is when somebody called me a nigger.
Okay.
That's when I knew that there was a difference. You know, that there was a difference when I was defined differently. Prior to that, I mean, I was born in Charity. If you're from New Orleans and black, you were probably born in Charity.
I was born in Charity on the west.
Right. And, you know, and being from the Ninth Ward, okay, I don't remember too many white people being down where I'm from. Down
there. No, they had already moved out.
They had already moved out, right?
Yeah.
So,
they
you know,
spent their lives
everything out. I knew, my reality was black.
Okay.
So,
cultural.
There was no reason for me to redefine what I was.
Okay.
It wasn't until that exit. Then I began to realize by someone else's definition that I was something else. Okay. So I struggle with that. And I think most of us struggle with that, especially when you get that first shock that, you know, that there's a difference.
The terminology
yes.
of the word.
Yes.
And how you internalize.
Yes. And when I began to accept, I think the first time I began to accept the difference between being black and white is the first time I was angry when someone called me a nigger.
Okay.
It made me feel a certain kind of way. At that moment, I began to fight for what I thought was the dignity of black people.
Okay.
Not just for myself, of course.
Okay.
You know when you're angry, you fight for everybody.
Right.
You think everybody fight for you too, right?
Right.
And so it wasn't until, to be honest with you, it wasn't until about 10 to 15 years ago. And to be honest, it's how I started writing. It's because another black man, you know, thought I was treating him differently because he was darker skinned than me.
Okay.
I was angry. I came home. My wife told me to write how I feel down. That's how I started writing.
Okay.
So, but it wasn't until I began to examine what was I really angry about. And then what was it I was looking for in terms of the difference in equality. Right? And it wasn't until I began to really examine who I am.
Okay.
And not focus so much on the fact that I am black. Okay? I own that I'm black. I can't change that. I was born that way. Okay? I can't change that. But is that my problem? No, that's not my problem. Is that the problem with the rest of the world? No. They think it's their problem, but it's not their problem. I got over the fact that I'm black the moment I realized that I have to be human first.
That's right.
Okay? When I have to be human first.
If
I was born with pink, as an albino, there's nothing I can do about that.
Right.
Until I accept it, I'm going to be angry about it.
Mm-hmm.
The moment I accepted who I am, I learned how to be a better human.
Okay?
And I started to focus on that. That's actually how I gave the title Freedom as It Happened. Because everything I thought I was fighting for in terms of freedom and equality and rights,
the symptoms. Yeah.
Were symptoms.
Yes.
Exactly. That's exactly what they were. They were symptoms. And I was forgetting the fact that every moment we live is an opportunity for freedom. You know, we keep looking at freedom as something on the horizon, you know. You know, we see the sun that's setting behind the mountain, right? And we think the sun is right there behind the mountain. If you ran up to that mountain while the sun was sitting there, you'd see the sun was somewhere else, right? That's exactly how freedom is, like that carrot on the stick. It's an illusion, exactly. And the whole time that we're chasing after that one thing we think is sitting out on the horizon, it's been sitting right next to us the whole time. The whole time. And so I don't wake up every morning thinking I'm a black man.
Okay?
Someone else might define me as being a black man every time I wake up, but that's not the first thought that comes to my mind. I think about salvation. I think about my family. I think about how I'm going to take care of business. You know? That's what's on my mind. I don't wake up thinking, oh my God, I'm black, so this is how my day is going to go. Because if I did, that's exactly how my day is going to go. Because I'm going to define everything that's happening in that day is because I'm black.
Right.
Okay? Not because, you know, my responsibilities, not because of what I'm supposed to be doing, not because of the purpose, etc. I'm going to be focused on the fact the only reason you talk to me this way is because I'm black. The only reason my pay is this way is because I'm black. The only reason I can't get a better car is because I'm black. The only reason I don't have a nice house is because I'm black. Okay. As long as I'm focused on that, I'm never going to get where I need to be. Exactly. Okay? It's like focusing on the fact that your bone is broken. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as you're crying about your bone is broken, you ain't going to go see the doctor.
Right.
Right? Go see the doctor, fix the problem, and then get healed.
Right?
You start focusing on everything else. So, thank you for that question. That's an excellent question because I've pondered that question quite a bit. You know, do I wake up? Because when I end up in conversations, I usually bring that up. I don't wake up every morning. And that might sound crazy to some people, but I don't wake up every morning thinking I'm a black man.
Okay.
You know, I'm sure President Obama don't wake up thinking that either. You know, he don't wake up every morning.
At one point in your life, maybe not, but I used to look in the mirror many, many years ago as though God had done something wrong.
Yes.
Like, and then you had all the symbolism to reinforce that negative feeling that other people cultivate within you.
Mm.
And in essence of that, I just nourished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I came to realize I was nourishing the wrong thing.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So I had to, I guess, pretty much unlearn and relearn and had to learn.
That's a difficult, you know, that's a difficult process.
As a, you know, where I come from.
Mm-hmm.
As a who I am and who I'm becoming.
Yes.
That was, you know, pertinent.
And you can't know who you're becoming until you know who you are.
Yeah, who you are.
Mm-hmm. And I was telling my auntie Brenda I was having a struggle with that some earlier years in my 20s with identity crisis of who I am. And if I don't know who I am, how do I know where I'm going?
Yeah, absolutely.
That statement leading up to my question. I had some instances in my life where, you know, when it was coming up, we were all being called niggas and colored people and all this kind of stuff. But there was a time in my life I was coming out of a grocery store and there was a preacher. I never knew him until that day.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something said about a colored man doing something that I didn't know anything about.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing I knew is that he was running out of the store.
Mm-hmm.
So he asked me, he said, did you see the man that ran out of the store? I said, yeah, well, how do you describe it? So he was a colored man. He said, oh, well, he was a colored man. He said, I need to talk to you. And we walked the distance of about 20, 30 yards from the front of the store to where he was parked.
Mm-hmm.
And he proceeded to talk to me for about 30 minutes. The man had just bought a gallon of ice cream. And by the time we got through talking, his ice cream was melted.
Mm-hmm.
And he proceeded, we had to cross a highway, it was a two-way highway.
Mm-hmm.
And as the cars passed, he said, what color is that car right there?
Mm-hmm.
That one was black.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what color is that truck? The truck was green.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what color is this car? That one was red. He said, now, what color is that man you was talking about?
Mm.
You got it out.
Oh,
right.
Well, he had brown skin.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a colored man.
Huh? Mm-hmm.
So, that's all I knew at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So in the next 30 minutes from when we got to his car, he proceeded to give me a lesson that I haven't forgotten.
Yes.
And I've been passing it on the rest of my
life. Yes.
It has made a difference in how I speak to people, how I think about people, and how I let people talk to me.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That has made me, I would say, a much better man.
Yes.
And I can tell from the children I meet, especially because I was young at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was between 12 and 14 when that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, somewhere along the line, I got to do better and teach the ones that didn't do better.
Yes.
And it has worked for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand where you're coming from.
Yes, I appreciate that. Yes, yes.
Big difference.
Yes.
And a lot of the kids right now, they still know me from my hometown all the way up here to Baton Rouge. And they always see me, oh, Mr. Mitchell, I'm so glad you talked to me when you came. They got a better job. They got a better education. My most recent one, I'm not going to take too much of your time, was a young man, and she knows, and you probably know too, I'm always fixing stuff or doing things for other people. This young man, he knew me from being in I was a Boy Scout leader, and he was one of my troops. And he saw me one day after I was doing some work for one of the ladies of the churches that was helping me out with the scouts. And he saw me and he walking with his head down and everything. And I said, okay, what's the matter? He said, my daddy wanted me to go into the Army. I said, well, why? Because my brother's in the Army. I said, do you think you want to be in the Army? He said, no, I don't want to go. Because some stories his brother had told him were not very nice. And I said, well, what's the matter with school? He said, well, I'm not doing too good in school. I said, I might not make it to 10th grade. And I got a copy of his report card and everything. And he was barely, his teachers saw him and knew him real well and knew he was trying, but he just couldn't get the understanding of the way he would teach it. So I said, well, how about if I mentor you and I can teach you some of that math you didn't know and geography and stuff like that, which I was pretty good at. And I went and asked his mom, because he was staying with his mom at the time. Mom and dad were separated on divorce. I didn't know which one. So she said, sure, you can help him out with his work. And 10th grade, 11th grade, and up until graduation, he was on the honor roll. So that's the kind of changes that made to me.
Yes.
And the thing that it did for me when the preacher stopped me and said what color were these cars and what color was that name. And when they said, when I hear the word nigger coming out of our mouths now, I got to interrupt them. And I said, all right, define nigger for me.
I know the male perspective is different from the female. Yeah. I know my great-grandmother, Julia West Lewis, raised me to never be inferior to anybody. She said, nobody is better than you are. And always look a person in the eye. And whatever you need, you know, we were raised in the spiritual realm. You just go to God with it. And so I know it is different. And then certainly in by design, you know, women... it seems like the system is to tear down the males and uplift the women and keep that separation and keep families separated. But I understand more now being a grandmother and having a grandson. I didn't have any sons. I did have brothers. But I didn't really feed into how they were, you know, perceived and how they were making it in this world as being a black man as I do now. As I do now. And my grandson just turned 13, and so I'm doing everything I can to make sure that he doesn't succumb to being a, you know, a bad, in prison or in the graveyard and all this other negativity that are out there for black men. But I never really see color. I just see working to feed my family. Of course, you're going to have obstacles with people in your own race.
Right.
You know, I get more of that from people of my own race than people from the outside. But my grandfather, Tashaun Big Babe, was standing up there, would always tell me this. People don't have to be nice to you. They don't. But when they do, you always say thank you and be grateful for whatever anyone does for you. And those are two valuable lessons that I have and I keep with me, and they have no color.
That's
right. They have no color.
I mean,
at all.
I see color, but I process it different, though. Depending on how you verbalize as to how I discern you. Because you have different colors. People, expressions are different. So, having said that, I like to ask, when did poetry really, you say, well, this is me, the expression. Who are some of your great?
Some of the folks I've really come to admire and really study is one poet by the name of Chinua Achebe, out of Nigeria. Also, Kalamuya Salam is actually from New Orleans. Still lives in New Orleans. He is one of the radio stations. Actually, still does an online radio station promoting Black arts. And Askia Toure, who was the founder of the Black arts movement. Rest in peace, Samir Baraka. Abi Odun Oyewole, Gil Scott Heron. A lot of these folks, I actually grew up listening to their music. And then when I had the fortunate privilege of being able to interview quite a few of the folks I just named while I was doing radio on Freedom Verse Cafe. So a lot of them I've understudied. Brothers like Gandhi Hamilton from the Watts Prophets and sisters like Jane Cortez and Sarah Webster Fabio. And a few others that I've had the opportunity to really sit down and understand their work. And a lot of my understanding about, and one of the things I was going to add to that last point was, one of the things I had to learn was, you don't have to be angry to be Black.
That's right.
And for a long time, when I studied the works of folks like the Last Poets, it's real easy to get enthralled in some of the angry language. Because if you don't understand the times, you can actually misinterpret a lot of what's happening. And that's why I had loved the fact that I had an opportunity to talk to them. Because the 60s was different. You know, what Black people was going through in the 60s cannot be redefined today. And I could not reimagine myself living in the 60s, you know. Yes, yes, and yes, absolutely. You do have some people who will quickly. Yes. Right. So, and that was one of the things I had to learn, was that it's okay to be, to speak activism and speak, progressive change. And I think that's a natural requirement, is to create art that invokes change and revolutionary thinking. And I mean revolutionary not in the sense of grabbing guns, but revolutionary in the sense of change and evolving. There's a responsibility for that. And that's what I really appreciated about their works. One of the things I had to learn was to be able to decipher the lesson from the anger from their works. I mean, the artists themselves were angry because of the things that they were going through, but their message was prolific and profound to a point that it stands even till today. So studying a lot of them, and a lot, particularly one of my favorites is Gil Scott Heron. Studying a lot of their works, yes. And even, listening to some of his personal struggles, certainly helped me identify. And plus, my father grew up, played Gil Scott Heron. I think my father took it really hard when Gil Scott Heron passed away. I called him on the day that Gil Scott Heron passed away, and we talked for a while. But I listened to Gil Scott Heron almost every day because my father played him all the time, And so I even wrote his daughter, Gia, a letter telling her, a lot of times I felt like your father was more of a surrogate father to me because I grew up listening to his work, and taking lessons from his work, and I never met him. I even remember the album cover that she first appeared on, Gia was in like 1978. I think it was called Visions of a Man. And he's sitting there with his daughter in his hand. And, I felt like I knew her all her life, just because of his work, and particularly with the songs like, the song Your Daddy Loves You, I take a lot from what they do and study, and not just in Blacks. Because I've had the opportunity to travel, I've gotten the chance to, study some of the works of, Afghani poets in the Lindays, some of the stuff of Lisa Lopez Chow out of the Philippines. Incidentally, what I've learned is that the struggle isn't just national. The struggle across cultures, it's a global struggle. Lisa Lopez Chow is a Chinese Filipino woman, and imagine she's a Chinese Filipino woman living in the Philippines. How significant is that, or relative to that, is as an African-American, Chinese-Filipino, living in the Philippines, having to have an identity crisis, trying to struggle on which one she identifies with and what circle of friends she's going to hang with because of how they identify her, you know? Now, there's almost no other race in the United States that actually goes through that struggle. We don't call French French-Americans. We don't call Italians Italian-Americans. When it comes to African-Americans, we make sure we distinguish African and American. We put that hyphen there. As if we are neither one.
Yeah.
You know, we can't hold on to Americans because they don't see us as Americans. We can't hold on to Africa because Africa doesn't necessarily own us because we've never been there. So we sit somewhere in the middle there trying to hold on to an identity. And so a lot of times we're going to struggle with that, you know. But the part we have to remember is not to be angry with it.
Like Mr. In-Between, you know, sometimes you're seeing a rich family.
Right.
Law set aside for everybody.
Yes.
Not having experience or being able to contact with people that actually experience some of the horrible things we experience, like the Chinese.
Yes.
The Vietnamese.
Yes.
The Cambodians.
Yes.
People in Africa.
Yes.
Except, you know, on now and
right.
The globe. But then, yeah, well, I think I could have more privileges if I adopt this, if I assimilate.
Right.
But then at the same time, you need to really find out who you are. And
right.
When you develop who you are, then it
right.
is who you become.
Right. In a lot of ways, I don't actually identify myself as African American.
Yeah.
I either identify myself as black or on an application other. Because there is no category on it. There's no acceptable category for me on an application. You understand what I'm saying? Right. 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 Right.
Depending on the situation, we don't walk something out to make the system.
Right.
Right. I didn't have that privilege because my grandmother is as white as they should be. But my grandfather is your So my uncle married Filipino. And then my other uncle married somebody from over in Washington. I don't know what her nationality is. She's some kind of an Asian. So in my house, it was a gumbo. You call somebody out their name, it was going to be a bad misunderstanding. We didn't understand what they were saying.
Right.
Right. That relates me back. You ever heard of Abby Lincoln?
Yes. Abby Lincoln, yes. I love her music.
I heard a song that she sung that that's me, you know, it impacted me. Profile was like, you know what?
Right, right.
With that dog, right. Gumbo, yeah. So,
yes.
You know, I connect to what she was
most
saying.
Most of us are. I mean, you be real about it. Most of us are.
You know, you embrace your ethnicity.
Yes.
I guess things really start to change. Some of it change in a negative way.
Yes.
Express themselves. Become, more self-destructive. Proactive.
Yes.
And trying to find an identity.
Yes.
And not really sure, but at the same time, it's like this is all I can see, so let me identify with that.
Right.
So there's a lot of symbolism. Plays a major factor as to how we perceive things.
Yes, yes.
Now, you know, a lot of black folks, I'm sorry to say, and I'd like to ask you, do you ever look at the other fellow man with suspicion? I do. It's like, because...
There's only one set of people that I look at with suspicion. Cops.
Yeah,
and I honestly think... There's a predisposition, you know, behavioral, you know, behavioral. It's just cops. And it's probably because I watched my father dunk from cops. I watched my uncles dunk for cops. You know, so, you know, it's almost genetic that I think I'm supposed to dodge cops, you know. So,
right. Isn't it amazing when you duck when you know you're straight?
Right. Even when I know I'm straight, I'm still ducking. You know? I slow down a little bit, you know. Okay.
And when you have your sons, you have to give them that book.
Yes. Yes.
I tell you,
you have to educate them on how they ask the cops.
I haven't had a chance to get in the mind.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I will tell you the first poem, The Untitled 34, that was actually a very, and I thought about that not just on in my own upbringing, but I also thought about my daughter. You know, when she comes and tells me she wants to be the president of the United States, am I going to tell her to take another dream? You know,
absolutely.
Am I going to? But in reality, that's what we do. You know, they say, baby, only one person can become the president. You're never going to have a shot at that.
You know, it's like Anglo-Saxon do when you pose that same question to your teacher. Hey, you know, I want to be a fireman. Oh, Gregory, you can't be no fireman. You know, you could be a good garbage man, you know.
Right.
Right.
He called it freaking the brain with
yes.
the needle.
Long yes.
So, I mean, it's not right for you to prick your kid's brain with the needle.
Right.
You
right.
don't support it.
Right.
Response it. You understand?
Right.
And embrace it.
Mm-hmm.
And nurture that,
mm-hmm.
and I like how you touch base on that.
Mm-hmm.
Second poem, I think it
yes.
Whereas you know when your daughter comes,
yes,
daddy,
yes, yes.
Stop, you know, Moses, stop playing. Why,
yes,
why you play so much?
Right, right. Come back when you're serious.
Yeah. Intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And when you throw at them like that, first of all, they grow as enthusiastic
right.
to what their aspiration
right.
might be. And then it's repressed, unknowing anger about dad. He really didn't support that.
Right.
So, oh, I'm mad at him.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, so you have those factors that I think play a significant role.
I mean, I would even.
Psychological development.
Right, and I would even throw the rhetorical question out there. This is not for answer. Think about it. Mm-hmm. How many people in this room are exactly what they said they wanted to be when they was a child?
and how many things that your parents imposed that you should be?
Right. I mean,
yeah,
that, you know.
You're going to be this here, what? Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, as long as you stay in this house, you're going to do what I say.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So the same way, everything mama, daddy was saying is correct. And,
yes.
Know, well, by virtue of the fact that they are bound, we
absolutely.
Tightened up, we had discussed it with someone else.
Yes. Yes. So my next poem, this one is sort of dear to me. And I'll talk about it in a little bit. This one's called Things We Remember. And I think everybody in this room can be touched by this one. Or What We Choose to Forget. The thirst goes on. The pain lives on and the rain has went on and lives have moved on. And my tears felt a lot like rain, but they had the texture of pain. They cried with the voices of children searching for safekeeping in buildings, sitting on rooftops, praying that someone would just stop it from rising. It rose 3 days before the water could cool the sores in my throat, and people floated by with no boats, souls kept praying, just trying to maintain hope, standing in water around their necks like yoke, breathing life, trying not to choke on lies in the eyes of insurance companies, fables that rolled off the tongue as sweet nothings. I got front row tickets to a football game, but no Saints took the field. Instead, the games played were a damn shame. Waited for water in the rain for 3 days. They say that FEMA was the blame, but when they failed, where was the rest? It has been years since the levees broke, since my childhood playground reconstructed itself as scars, scar tissue in the memory banks of my chest. We are forgotten like dying soldiers on foreign sands, and with the change of the channel, we have become the tragic afterthoughts of what was the faint memory of a lost curiosity. And while programming goes on, we sleep under bridges, die on rooftops, swept away from memories because they figured out who to blame. But who was to blame for the change of name from citizens to refugees? In this land we helped bring to fame, although it was through a dark-stained history. Yet, I am reminded of how she still sees me, just another face in the crowd that doesn't live in the Florida Everglades, but in some broken black city. Though this city is home to jazz and the sweetener in their coffee, it is treated as the bitter boot with a hole in it. The place I call home, where the saints march in, this dome where rooftops are torn and lives changed from the screams in the fan stands where young girls were raped by some cowardly man, I don't think you understand how stories were whispered of loved ones who were eaten before ushered on. Things in this country are still the same, where some throw a little change but are afraid of making it, as long as their homes aren't blown away. If my tears had lips, they would speak of this pain. I cry for the lies told to those who waited and waited. I cry for those who slept in watery graves, for those who did not get a second line, for those who let us slip their minds, for those who've learned how to survive. And I cry for the rain that falls, the rain that feels a lot like pain. Dad and I flew kites where our hopes and tears formed on the riverbanks.
You know, it's a pleasure to be here listening to this because you take me back and you help me to see and realize a lot of the things that went on. Mm-hmm. And the way you express it is absolutely wonderful, really. Mm-hmm. Make you think. Mm-hmm. And so, very impressive the way you put the words together. Mm-hmm. And you not only paint the picture, but you are building a verbal monument, as I call it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be thinking about it, mm-hmm. reading about it a long time. Mm-hmm. Just because of the way you could put the words together and make your mind mm-hmm. move around and go mm-hmm. and think mm-hmm. even further than I have been. So mm-hmm. I appreciate being here.
I appreciate anyway. That poem because you were so many, many miles away, mm-hmm. but yet you were still affected mm-hmm. by it. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I know that you were praying and crying and feeling our pain over mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm.
Because
we're connected.
Mm-hmm. I feel it's not hard to grasp the way you directed it, the way mm-hmm. you worded it, mm-hmm. the terminology used for the people that actually experienced that.
Yes.
I stayed in New Orleans for a little mm-hmm. while, and it was like different factions within the city.
Yes.
I stayed on Legion Field, mm-hmm. so I'm already exposed to too many things in the nine. Third Ward up there, but it was a possibility that those things could have existed
yes.
in certain mentalities
yes.
as people would copy old
yes.
blacks in New Orleans. It was inhumane the way those people were treated, having experienced a disaster yeah. like that. Now, it's questioned about whether or not the levee was breached. Well, I like to feel if I had to say, yeah, it was breached. So the Mississippi came in there and washed houses away, washed lives away. It didn't wash no sins away.
And
the same folks right. blame you for the skin you was in.
Yes.
yes. know, and they somewhat added insult to injury.
Like, yes.
You know, you're all the reason all this happened.
Right.
Like you said, all the confidence and fame,
right.
all the rhetoric, you
right.
know, we got all this in the place where you've seen people trudging through waters.
Right. Right.
All the way up to their neck.
Right.
Above their heads.
Mm-hmm.
And then not to mention that white folks like to use this here when you have something like that, Negroes looting.
Right.
What is it?
Negroes looting and shooting.
Mm-hmm.
So they
when they sent black water down.
Yeah, they further victimized.
Right.
So, well, I mean, it's like this here. All cultures done the same thing.
Absolutely.
And when I look at my race and I said, damn, you know, y'all need to freeze that. You know, it's like, but you know what? That exists in all cultures. But
right.
for some reason, just, I don't know, in some way, it's said that it's more powerful to black people as to how we are them, like, you know,
oh, yeah,
and they sensationalize.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess some just lose hope.
Mm-hmm.
Others keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And some just really don't know.
Right.
Really don't know.
Right.
But I think that people more exposed to writings like that, audio aspect, where you can hear it, plant
right.
the seed,
right.
and maybe something that could touch them
yes.
that have a profound
yes.
Effect as how they start to reconstitute their life.
Right. Like you said, I was miles away, but even though I was miles away, I felt helpless because every day I think I was on the phone with you, and you were stuck in the building, and I'm in the Navy. We have boats, and I'm sitting there thinking, why can't we just send? I'm asking to go on leave so I can go down there and do something. They keep telling me no. You know, why can't we send the Navy down there to pick them people up?
Yeah.
Well, that's not our job, you know.
Absolutely.
So, imagine, you seeing your home, you know, being drowned, and you working for an organization
yeah.
that has boats. You know what I'm saying? That a flood happens in the Philippines, we'll send ships over there to help.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? We go to Thailand, we send them over there. But right here at home, we couldn't send a single boat to pick up anybody. You know, so imagine my anger, you know, standing there on the sideline, just all I can do is look, you know, imagine it.
Did the association, the military, did it change your attitude when?
Oh, it did for a while.
Those,
oh, it absolutely did.
Services,
it absolutely did. And I actually have a note here that I wrote from the last time I did a reading, and I think it's more fitting that I read this note now,
okay.
And because it has sort of explained. I'm still angry about it, but I've reconciled with it, if you will. And the note I wrote from the last reading was that poetry allows for the reconciliation of the past with the present, and the acceptance of the potentiality of the future. Because that's by writing it and exposing that anger and trying to make sense of it, I can look at it, revisit it, and re-examine, you know, where I am and what reasons go with it, etc. To be honest with you, every time I read that poem, I don't know if you heard it in my voice, but every time I read, I've written 10 poems about Katrina, okay? And there's another one in here. It's called Mulatto Blues. That's in the book. It's written a little different, but that was also about Katrina. I've written several poems about Katrina because I still haven't completely reconciled it.
Yeah, so I kind of detected that. So you kind of feel the need to, I guess it's, as opposed to burying it, you decide. To
I can't bury it.
Can't
I can't bury it.
Nothing
you know?
With stipulations. by whatever ways and means necessary in order to I guess, put things in place, more things in place, mm-hmm. like they weren't already in place, mm-hmm. is that the people that were in charge of delivering those mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. didn't really do it.
Right.
Yeah, so I think I see.
I mean, if you're hurting on something, because she hurt you,
yeah.
how are you going to reconcile your pain?
No, you can't.
The only way you can reconcile that pain is you sit and talk with her,
yeah.
and you make her understand what you're feeling. Mm-hmm. And that's the only reason I say I haven't reconciled with it, because until I know that other people understand, you know, what happened,
yeah.
what people still surviving and trying to reconcile through, because we still have people who are still displaced and haven't moved back to New Orleans, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's like this, just celebrations and birthdays,
yes.
it becomes a reality because
yes.
you know everybody's displaced and,
right.
you know, homegoings and celebrations will
right.
be the same
yeah.
as everybody's scattered.
You don't know
right.
But the earth purges itself every
yes.
thousands of years anyhow. The tragedies are, you know,
right.
they're bound
right.
to happen as long as the earth is in
mm-hmm.
existence. Now, how we handle that tragedy,
right.
we as black people can say if it was another a culture of people, they may have responded better.
Mm.
But we really don't know. We can just assume that
yeah.
from... You know, and in regards to Katrina, we got the bad weather, but the water rose and the levees, whether it was partially or whatever, it went to the area that wasn't profitable for the city because
mm-hmm.
New Orleans is a tourism city and they're
yeah.
going to protect
right.
the tourism. And if you are poor, you know, and, you know,
and
right the whole time and not get in
there. Yeah.
yeah.
How did you channel that? At that moment when you asked them, you know, why can't we...
I shut down.
You just
yes.
said you was cold.
I was cold. I was shut down. I mean, my superiors couldn't try to get me to understand the reason why they say no, you know. Of course, later on, I understand that, you know, operation, you couldn't get anybody in New Orleans at that time, you know. So even if they had told me yes, how was I going to get in the city, you know? And then if I would have been, would I have been any good in the city if I had landed, you know, went down as a lone person myself?
That's the point you started to rationalize?
Yes. Well, that's the part I start to rationalize. I can't rationalize why we didn't send ships down there. I can't rationalize that, you know. That the personal part I can rationalize, okay? Personal part of me, because I think the natural part of us, if something happened to one of your family members who was in Kentucky, and right now you are without a car or any money, you're still going to feel bad about not being able to get up there to Kentucky to help your family, right? Even though it's beyond your control to be able to get up there. You might even start trying to walk or hitchhike up there, but yes. Yes.
Obligations.
Yes. But that's the personal part.
Yeah,
you know, the fact that we have organizations in place that could help and don't, that part you can't rationalize with.
Absolutely.
You know, that's the part you have to, and I think that's the part of what we have to remember about Katrina is we can't bury it. We have to remember it because we have to remember that we have to prepare ourselves to be prepared for not getting the help.
Absolutely.
You know,
that's right.
We have to be prepared for not getting the help.
Absolutely.
Because if you're prepared for not getting the help and you get the help, you're still good.
You got to be proactive.
You understand what I'm saying? So that's the part about what we have to remember. We have to remember the lessons of what we learned from it. That's why I say I can't bury it. I have to read this poem and remember it every time because there's something to be learned out of that.
Absolutely.
You know, and if there was nothing else that we didn't learn from it, we should have learned that what we thought was equal certainly wasn't.
Definitely.
And people may not see it, but it's a legacy.
Yes.
That has been
laid yes.
out that leads to you.
Yes. All right, so I love reading this next poem because this next one is sort of like an homage to almost every woman that's ever been in my life. And I think y'all will like this one. I have fun reading this one. So, as time, she has always been present. Sand through melted versions of itself, hands shifting in revolutions, days gone, moonshine. She cries as she gives birth. Gravitationally changing the course of the tide, a new day is coming. From the womb of a wounded mother, her history lives. Pride to a father, strength to her worth. For 9 moons, she carried and comforted the sun with her tears, her songs, her prayers to conjure the sun from her belly. Stop dragging your feet, she'd say. The world is waiting for your light. Stop dragging your feet, son. Men don't drag their feet. But why, mama? Because men be about their business. Her wisdom was always this witted and equally persistent. And although I had great men in my life, it was the impact of these women that remains significant. Who else motivates you, keep you on your toes, always on the job, avoiding going broke because they certainly deserve the occasional upgrade from coach? Yes. It was women who taught me great lessons. Mother. A revolutionist and historian who continued to impress upon me that despite human evolution, it's all bound to repeat itself in revolution. So learn the lesson the first time, son. Ima, who taught me what it means to struggle, survive, and love despite the conditions, to find a woman of valor, one who will instill the same in our son. Grandmother, a nurse who magically healed the hurt with sugar and butter on toast, she gave hope to an empty stomach. She would boast more than often that I am her first. Great-grandmother, one who made us pick switches, who affirmed, spare the switch, spoil the child. Besides, she was nothing to mess with. Then there was the principal woman, Shaira, who cared enough about education. Sister Elisheva, math teacher, who taught me that 1 + 1 was sometimes circumstantial when it comes to 2, since you could end up with 3 or 4 jobs trying to support the miscalculations. And Sister Galina, language teacher, where syntax and context were the most important subjects. It was in her class that I learned a good deal about women. She taught me about ellipses and periods and how, if missed, the consequences of misunderstood sentences. And then there was this very peculiar thing she would say. Commas are for pauses, so use prudence as you proceed. And they aren't always followed by buts. But buts are just the beginning of excuses, and you'd be best to avoid this. Then there was my geography teacher, who convinced me that I could be anywhere I wanted to be besides here. She said, stagnation is the impetus to procrastination, so go and be free. Stop stalling on what could have been or should have been, for wherever you land is where you should be. And see, I didn't understand that logically, but that could probably be because it was geography and not philosophy. Yes, an excuse. Then there was those who gave me theology, science, biology, livology, and chemistry. And speaking of which is my wife, who said the most important 3 words, I am here. She stood by my side, giving me the strength to overcome many obstacles, stood on the shores awaiting my return from far-off lands, washed and ironed every uniform while managing a career of her own as a chemist. And we have more than chemistry. She is friend and advisor in everything I know about the intimate respect of women I learned from her. I'm going to stop right there. I'm going to stop right there. Yeah.
I think this is Stacey's favorite part.
Yes, honey.
I need
them. It's important that men have significant. But one of the things I just recently posted on Facebook is that, you know, what daughters learn most of in their life about being women, they learn from their fathers. And what sons get from their mothers is what daughters get from their fathers. Sons learn how to respect women, and they learn the most intricate lessons from women. You know, women generally are the providers, the disciplinarians, the teachers, the nurse that heals the wounds and whatnot. And it takes a really good woman, a really good woman to raise a really decent man. It really does. It's not just men. Because, see, men know how to raise other men, but they know how to raise other men to be, well, men.
men pretty much know how to take care of themselves, but, you know, when the innocence is taken, you know, you give them a reason. Like May said, you give them a reason. And women have given men reasons.
Yes.
Now, they're going against the grain. Now, I mean, you know, with these. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you know, you got 12 years of your mom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got until you get out the household and right. Mix up with your mother.
Right.
than the close relationship, intimacy with your grandmother, mm-hmm. then, you know, it's some things that, well, okay, I got a girlfriend now, and I ain't trying to, you know, feel what, you know, mom was telling me. So we start to break down and analyze and define what we feel a woman should be.
Right. Now, if you notice it, you might be a pop mouth around pops, but you ain't going to be one around mom. You're going to be decent around your mama.
You know? You get all busted up, that is important because, like you said, the black woman is the cradle of civilization.
Yes.
You know, it's like and especially when the black man was beat down, and whatever else it was the black woman that made the man feel like a king. You know, with once nice and toast, no house, living in a psychedelic shack.
Yes,
you understand?
Yes,
you know you can do it. So that is really
yes.
They continue to believe in us.
Mm-hmm.
Say, well,
mm-hmm. So, you know, we was in 7-Eleven in Japan.
Okay.
And it was about a few weeks ago. And we was in 7-Eleven in Japan. And they had toast with butter and sugar on it.
Wow.
Wrapped in a packet. The first thing I thought of was my grandmother.
I hate
this. And guess what? Grandma, how you make your tea? Boy, that's a secret.
You can try, like you said, you can put the sprinkle of sugar on there first and then try to put the butter on top to make it stick, and it ain't gonna taste like grandma did. Right? Yes. You want me to read from your book? Okay.
We are so happy. I'm so proud that my husband finally was able to publish this book. It's been something he's wanted to do for years. And we were just so touched that Aunt Brenda decided to help us, you know, get started and set up these book readings here in New Orleans. And we wanted to get you something, let you know that we love you dearly, and you will never be forgotten.
Oh.
And somebody might want to, you might want to open him now, because he might want to read. He wrote something for us. For you. Open that.
She loves opening stuff. So, be careful, because that stuff is.
No, we like glitter.
Okay.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, you sent me a message on Facebook after you got the book, and you said you was gonna start writing. I inspired you to start writing.
Yes.
So I decided to get you a journal to make sure you start writing.
Right.
Okay. So
hold her accountable.
Yeah.
Hold her accountable. Yeah.
Hold her accountable. Right.
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 So this is her journal, and he wrote the message in here too. It's for Titi, okay?
Oh my
God!
So I got you a little something.
Oh, that is gorgeous!
And,
thank you so much.
One of the things I find very important. I write poems every day. I find a reason to write something every day. And in fact, the day my wife told me to write how I felt down was the first day that I started writing, and I haven't stopped writing since. Because I realized I had a whole lot of things I needed to put down. Okay? So I wrote you a poem that probably will never be published anywhere else except for what's in that frame right there. And I like handwriting because I think handwriting is going to be a lost art. Because you have a whole generation of people who don't even know how to write. Right. So, you know, I remember, you know, when I was her age, you know, my dad would give me them little fat little pencils with the tracing paper and whatnot. And, You know, there's a great deal when it's a penmanship. So I spend a lot of time handwriting. I actually always handwrite my poems before I type them anyway. So,
thank you so much. We love you too.
So first of all, I had a few people I need to thank. To my parents, for teaching me and giving me that guidance. And to my lovely wife of 13, actually it's 13 and a half years. We'll be 14 in October.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's 14. Yeah. It's, ain't nothing gonna happen between now and then. So Yeah.
You know. He gave a lot of information. Yeah. That's good.
You know, for being the impetus and me becoming a writer and supporting my creativity. To my lovely Aunt Brenda, for supporting and putting on this bringing everybody together and putting this thing together. And, bringing freedom as it happens to Baton Rouge and also subsequently to New Orleans. And so I appreciate that. And for those who helped in spreading the word, Melanie, and bringing folks out. And to my daughter for her patience and energy.
She didn't do nothing.
Or lack thereof.
Right.
And lastly, you
for receiving me.
Amen.
You know, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And I have some books here for those who haven't picked up one. If you're interested in getting one, I have books here for autograph and signing. And if you already have one, I'll be able to sign that too. Books are $15, and I have them at the end of the table. And again, I want to say thank you for spending a couple hours with me.
Of you all who are in the area on Saturday the 28th, Tashambe will have his book signing at the community bookstore.